Hey, thanks for joining me on the very first iHeart Guitar podcast. I'm Peter Hodson, and it's about time I did this, right? So, what we're going to do here is, this first episode is going to consist of three interviews. We've got Rich Ward from Fozzy, we've got Tony McAlpine, and then we've got an archival interview with Tony Iommi, which I did for Mixdown magazine in 2016. So the recording quality is going to vary a bit because some of these weren't recorded specifically with a podcast in mind, especially in the case of Iommi, that was for print. So I probably would have conducted it differently if I knew I was ever going to be listened to, especially fanboying there in front of Tony Iommi on a telephone. Funny story, I was actually sitting in my car outside my kid's school doing that interview at 9 a.m. So you'll probably hear like birds and traffic and stuff, but it's Iommi, what are you going to do? So as the podcast goes on, we're going to have, guest hosts joining me. We're going to have longer interviews. Might even do some on-site kind of blog pods from different locations when there are cool events to cover. And yeah, we'll see how it evolves. For now, I've got these three cool interviews for you, and I hope you enjoy it. First up is Rich Ward, and the new Fozzy record comes out this Friday through Century Media, and it's incredible. Here's Rich Ward. Now, the first thing that really stands out to me about this record is there are some songs that have a real kind of industrial groove thing going on. Where did that come from?
That was very much down to the producer, Johnny Andrews. This is the first time that we've collaborated with an outside producer in over a decade. And he's very much influenced by everybody from Nine Inch Nails to Depeche Mode to Soundgarden. And he really loves dark music. And so those production elements came from him. Now, I've always used loops. I've always really enjoyed electronica and dance elements, which you hear quite a bit on Do You Want to Start a War, and even some on, tracks from previous records as well. But I think because, our goal on this record was not just to hire a producer to push buttons, but was to really have someone involved in the writing process and the creative process, like a sixth member of the band who had an equal say at the table. And we felt like we needed that because, we've been a band who there's been a lot of start-stop because, I have Stuck Mojo and Chris has wrestling and, Paul DeLeo has Nina and Billy Gray is in Madame Mayhem, and so we're all doing, and Frank's got a very successful cover band, so we're all doing multiple things when we're not doing Fozzy. And we really felt like that we had gotten ourselves into kind of a bit of a pattern of how we make records. Chris sends me lyrics, I write songs sometimes to his lyrics, sometimes I'm writing demos and song structures and trying to incorporate his lyrics onto my existing ideas. But it all really kind of stems from Rich Ward solo project writing with Chris's lyrics. And we felt like we wanted to open this thing up into a different dynamic where the whole band was participating more and we had a producer who was acting as a coach. And so there would be some influences that people are going to recognize that may not be as strong in other records. And that's just coming from us taking a different approach to making a record.
Yeah, cool. The guitar sounds on this thing are massive. what's going on? What's going into the guitar tones?
It's mainly a JCM 800 and a Spawn Pro Stock. So the Spawn is a bit of a darker amp, and it's the gain is more saturated, where the 800 has the focused mid-range and is a little more open sounding. So on some of the songs there's four tracks, two of each, and then some is just a Spawn in the left speaker and the 800 in the right. I did use an original early 70s Plexi on some of it, where I really needed a much more open sounding, EL 34 voicings, because my Marshall and my Splawn have 6550s. So the profile tonally is different on those amps. And then I had a Friedman Brown Eye that I tracked with, and I used a couple of other amps, like an EVH3, the new Fender EVH amp, which I really like that amp. But those amps were used as texture tones; they weren't primary rhythm stuff. And then the lead amps, I was experimenting with lots of different amplifiers depending on what the tuning of the, because you know how it is. I mean, as someone like yourself who's a tone guru, you know, it's really important to find a rhythm tone and a lead tone that find their own space. Because if you're using the same amp and guitar on your rhythms and your leads, especially if you're tracking rhythm underneath the leads, they're covering the same sonic area, and it's nice to have a little bit of sonic separation where they can both have their own little real estate. So I use, you know, Charvels and Les Pauls and a PRS baritone. I mean, there's a lot of different guitars. I used my Dean ML and a Dean Tele, the Nash Vegas, which is that the Tracy Gunn signature Tele, which has a Floyd Rose on it. I have been buying so many amps and guitars over the years, and precisely for this reason, which is that the more crayons that you have in the box, the more colors that you can paint with. And I always find it fun to have a box full of pedals and a box full of, you know, interesting noise making devices, and really just trying to work with what works best for the riff and the song.
Plus, there's something really inspiring about doing that instead of just pressing a button on a processor and moving to the next sound, you know?
Yeah, and that is the thing that I know, just from speaking with some guitar player friends of mine, that they're using a lot of virtual instruments, and nothing wrong with that. But I am an older guy. I mean, I'm 48. This is my 19th album, and my first albums that I recorded on 2-inch tape, and it's a different process. It requires a different approach and a different focus. And I have noticed for myself that as I have allowed myself to use the tools available to me more so over the years, that there have been bits and pieces of the personality of my playing that have maybe disappeared a bit. And that's not the technology's fault. That's my fault, because I love the tools, right? I mean, everyone loves these. Everybody just talks, oh, you could edit too much. It's like, listen, we edited in the 80s and 90s too. You just had to have a very patient guy with a razor blade and some tape. You know, now you could just edit digitally. And so people are just editing more because it's easier and takes less time. I mean, people were auto-tuning years ago. They just used analog gear to do it with. And I think the real key to a great guitar track is use the tools that are available, but decide, not can I, but should I, on utilizing the technology. And sometimes it really just requires a lot of rehearsal, really knowing every nuance of the part, because as a guitar player, nobody knows this more than you do, and that most of the tone is coming from my right hand picking technique and how I'm syncing with my left hand and how much movement is in my left hand, because I create vibrato with my left hand even when I'm playing rhythm stuff. And so the more married I am to these riffs and the deeper the relationship I have with these parts, the better the parts will sound, just because I'll be able to inject more personality and energy into the performances.
Yeah, totally. So, what are your current guitar obsessions? Is there a piece of gear or, you know, anything that you're really into right now?
Yeah, I mean, you'll hear it a lot on the record. My favorite kind of little pedal is the full tone octave fuzz pedal. I'm madly in love with that pedal. It just has the coolest overtones, and the fuzz is just incredible. I mean, I'm a big kind of, you know, I mean, everyone's a Hendrix fan. So, but there are other guys who just
Robin Trower. There's so many guys that were just so good with that kind of octave fuzzy sounds, and it's my new obsession pedal-wise. But my new, my obsession guitar-wise for years have been mid-70s Les Pauls. They have a smaller neck profile, which really suits the size of my hand and my playing style. And I also like them because those 75, 76, 77, almost all of them were maple neck guitars, so they're a bit brighter tonally. So for drop tunings, you have less of that kind of dark mahogany stuff that can start to feel and sound like mud in lower drop tunings. And then they're pancake bodies, which is basically, for those who don't know, that's two pieces of mahogany glued together with a little sliver of maple in between. And Gibson was doing that because, you know, mahogany was expensive and the market was down, and so they were trying to save money by not having to have these big slabs of mahogany to build bodies out of. But it created a sound. There's an interesting vibe to those mid-70s pancake bodies, and they're not as desirable for collectors. So you can get into one for a pretty reasonable price. You know, they may need a fret job. They may need, you know, new electronics and some things. But ultimately, most guitar players are buying guitars for, the neck and the body. You know, a lot of us are like, we grew up with Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhoads, where we like to experiment with different pickups and different fret sizes. And so all of that stuff, all that customization, I do myself. But I'm obsessed with those. Like I said, I have more mid-70s Les Pauls than just about anybody I know. And I hope this podcast doesn't encourage other people to go buy them all up and drive the price up.
Well, the tricky thing is there are some great ones out there, but there's also, you know, that wasn't Gibson's best era. So, you know, there are some really good ones, but people tend to hold on to them and they get harder to find.
Yes, and you're right. There's tons of stinkers, and a lot of that comes down to as well is, you know, that three-piece maple neck. There was something about that caused the necks to twist. It was great because the hard maple kept from having headstocks popping like you had from the early 70s Les Pauls. But the other part is that having those three pieces, they have a tendency to move a bit. And you're right, and there's some real dogs out there. But I will have to say, with how cheap they are, you know, you can find them on the eBay for anywhere between $1,500 and $2,500, depending on condition and how original the parts are. And if you're willing to take the risk and buy one, and if it doesn't work, you know, they hold their value pretty good. You could just, you know, turn it around and sell it. So that's what I've been doing for a number of years. And yeah, so, but I also have a 74 Blue Sparkle Top that, is not a pancake body, and it's a brilliant guitar, and it's a maple top but mahogany neck, and it's a beast. But it weighs about 12 pounds, so I don't even take it out on tour because you'll literally have to carry a chiropractor on the road with you. It's an absolute boat anchor.
Especially with the way you perform and jump around and stuff.
I know. I'd have to have a whole like a staff of folks to take care of neck and back damage.
So let's see, man, we've burned through my questions here, but there's one question I love to ask people because the answer is always different and always interesting. What does the guitar mean to you?
What does guitar mean to me?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it would be a multifaceted answer, but to try to winnow it down to what has been the most important thing for me is that it helped me to kind of define who I was, because I'm a smaller guy, so I was never going to be successful at sports. Even though I did play soccer and baseball, I just was never going to be, that was never going to be something I was going to carry forward in life with other than just for enjoyment. And, I wasn't born with 170 IQ, so I was never going to be a scientist. And I really believe that, that nature selects us for certain things based on, by winnowing out and taking away things that maybe we're not genetically predisposed for. And I remember just, there was a guy that lived down the street from me, and I remember I would walk sound. I would hear him just jamming super loud, playing guitar. One day I walked up on his front doorstep. I was 13 years old. I owned my own guitar, but I wasn't very good. You know, like all of us that starting off, I barely knew how to play some chords. And I remember looking at all his stacks of amps in his house, and he was probably in his mid 20s, and he had super long hair and a big beard. And this was probably 1981 or 82, you know, something like that. And I just remember looking at him and thinking, that's the coolest guy I've ever seen. And he's holding an old SG and stacks of amps. And I just remember what an impact it had on me. And I remember then just really inspired to play more, because I just wanted to imitate and emulate this guy who, again, made, you know, I was awestruck. And he was not somebody famous. He was just a guy who knew how to play Joe Walsh songs. You know, he was just your next door neighbor who had a guitar. And so as I started playing, it really gave me a focus for my life, because then I was, you know, putting on a Black Sabbath record and trying to learn how to play it. It gave me direction. I wasn't just some kid now who rode his bike around or his skateboard around the neighborhood with nothing. It gave me purpose. So all of a sudden, my life felt like it meant something, because I had something to channel all of my time and energies in. And then, you know, one day I was that guy who could all of a sudden play these songs. And I remember just that self-esteem, because things have changed over the years. You know, self-esteem used to be you didn't need anyone to tell you that you were great. Self-esteem was just the sense of accomplishment that you had because you learned how to play, you know, all of Master of Reality or all of Volume 4, or, you know, you could learn the rhythm tracks on the first Van Halen record. You know, I'd never learned the solos until I was much older, because that was obviously there was a level of difficulty, but just that sense of accomplishment. And that carries through to everything I do in life, which is that things that are hard to do are worth doing because the sense of accomplishment and self-esteem that you get from it. So I think guitar for me is just, it's been something that I've been able to create a life for myself out of. And because my first experience with guitar was my neighbor, just a regular guy, I never cared about being famous or using guitar to have a nice car or to have a big house. My initial relationship with guitar was just seeing the power of one guy holding an SG through a stack of Marshalls and the sound that it created, and all the way to where I am now, several decades later, that's still what I live for. When I do sound check, it's still that moment of tweaking every little thing about the amp to try to make it utilize the room in the best way possible. And I'm still that geek who wants to be what my neighbor was, which was that badass dude with the freaking crazy ass beard and super long hair who could play guitar.
That's so awesome. Well, that looks like our time up. So thanks so much, Rich. It's been great to talk, and, you know, thanks for being a part of the podcast, and congratulations on another kick-ass album.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And listen, I would be honored to be to do a part two or a part three anytime that you want. You know that I have a man crush on you, so anytime that you have you know, time and you'd love to speak with me, it would be a real honor.
Hell yeah, that'd be really cool. Thank you.
You got it, Peter. Well, man, you take care of yourself. Thanks again for everything, and I'll look forward to speaking with you down the road.
Cool. Catch you soon. See ya.
You got it. Thanks, Peter. Bye.
Next up, we've got Tony McAlpine, whose new record is called Death of Roses, and it's the first thing he's recorded since his battle with cancer recently. It's a brilliant album. Again, this interview was conducted for print, so, you know, forgive me if it doesn't sound that great. As I said, as we go on, I'll get better equipment for properly recording these things for broadcast. But for now, enjoy this chat with Tony McAlpine.
Hello?
Hey, this is Peter Hodson from iHeart Guitar. How you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Pretty good.
How's it going?
Good.
Great.
It's 3 a.m. down here in Australia.
What time is it?
3 a.m.
3 a.m. in Australia. Oh, yeah. That's early.
Early or late.
The breakfast show.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
right.
Yeah, so Mike sent me the album a couple of days ago, and, dude, I'm blown away, and it's so good to hear you playing again, you know, obviously.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, everyone was, you know, pulling for you, and, you know, to have you put out an album again and be back on the road and stuff is just awesome to see, so, yeah, I'm really glad.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, yeah. So, yeah, we're really happy to actually be out there and doing it again, and, you know. Mm. That's what we're here for, so we're busy at it.
Yeah. So let's, I guess, start with the genesis of the record. I mean, you must have a whole bunch of new life experiences to draw from in writing this one. You know, how was it? How was it different from other records?
Well, I mean, the process is really the same. I mean, just, you know, after I was feeling better, I just really got, you know, was able to, you know, after at least a year, get back in the studio and just start really, you know, physically playing the instruments and creating the songs. And the process was really the same. There was nothing really that different. And just really, you know, working again with the engineer and you know, relearning how to do things. And, you know, and after that much time, a lot of things change in the, in the computers and stuff like that. So just being able to wrap my head around those things was something that took some time. But, you know, the creativity was there, and just being able to get the ideas together and surround myself with some incredible players, like, you know, that are featured on the record. Gurko Berlai is a player that I just think is an amazing drummer, and as to, you know, everyone just agrees, just unbelievable, you know, Hungarian player. Mm. And also, you know, playing again with Pete Griffin, who's just a remarkable, you know, who's done the MG Live videos for us, and he's done some shows for me before in the past, and just really understands, you know, instrumental and guitar music, you know, having, you know, working with Paul Gilbert and his band and all the different things that he's done, you know, with the Zappa, all kinds of stuff that he does. So, yeah, it's really good to be working with these wonderful players.
Yeah. I mean, a guy like Pete, I'm sure you could have quite easily, you know, played bass on your record and it would have been awesome, but someone like that brings, like, this whole depth of, you know, their own voice as well.
Well, yeah, you know, and I'm not really a bassist. I'm really just a guitar player trying to play a bass. And it's a whole different art, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole different feel, and that's what's important, really, to have those kind of guys that understand that instrument.
Yeah. So, do you feel, I mean, all of us as musicians, our style is changing and evolving all the time. Do you feel you've kind of come through the other side of this journey a different musician?
I wouldn't say directly related to any experiences that aren't musical related. I think that it's just, you know, what I've accomplished and what I experience just has to do with just life in general, you know, that really just the musical life, not really so much, you know, any kind of bumps in the road or things that, you know, maybe, you know, necessary for all those to differ. You know, I just was on a process of really creating some different things before, you know, I was sidetracked, and now I'm just able to really, you know, put those together. Mm. We're working again on the next 7 songs, like, which are part of the other half of this, you know, this EP that we put out, because we wanted these songs on Death of Roses to be revealed in a way that will be a reflection of the differences of the next 7 songs, which we should be completed shortly after we finish 28 dates here in this tour.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that. Why are they separate? Like, what's the difference in feel between the two?
Well, it's really just, we're going to, there's things that I've really, experimenting with, and the things that, I really don't want to all have on one record. The ability today in media allows you really, you know, the way that people buy single songs and the way people download records is, you know, you're able to, you know, mix and do folders and tracks rather than trying to have something all inclusive on one record. I just think it's a better listening experience to be able to separate the two, because they're going to be you know, the story will be told once they're revealed. But you know, the idea is that the two sit better on different albums than they do by themselves.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that this is only 30 minutes long, which, it you know, you pack a lot of music into that 30 minutes.
Yeah, it's a lot of listening.
I mean, you know, like...
It's a lot of listening.
Like, Edelman Smile was, like, 26 minutes or something, and there was nobody said, yeah, you know, that album's too long.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, we don't have a book there. But, you know, the way we look at it is, you know, it's instrumental music, and... a lot of times these records, because there's no vocals and people are used to that, they can become a little taxing, you know? Mm. So we really wanted to, if we had put all of these things together on one record, it would have been, you know, a lifetime of listening. So
Yeah.
So
let's talk equipment. What did you use on the record?
I used a record with my Hughes & Kettner Triumphs. Mm-hmm. And... you know, various different guitar approaches, but namely my 7 and 8 string Ibanez guitars, and outfitted with various different pickups that we just keep changing, you know, throughout different things, you know, to try to get different tones and stuff. So, yeah, you know, that's the part of a thing that we do, you have to do. But I just, yeah, it was a really simple setup that I've always used, really. Just, you know, the HK amps and the Ibanez guitars. And
yeah.
Nothing else really after that.
Yeah, I mean, you seem to have... You know, I know you've kind of, you'd gone back and forth with guitars over the years for a while, but you seem to have been loyal to the Hughes and Kettner for a long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a live setting, the amps are just really, just phenomenal also, because I use the, you know, the Grandmeister Deluxe 40s, which are, you know, they're fully programmable tube heads.
Mm.
You know, it's an all tube, you know, system, but it has, you know, built-in, you know, red box and built-in effects and everything, compression and everything goes into the head. So I really don't have to go out on the road with all kinds of different things. And I'm either using that or the core blades. So on this particular run, I'm using the core blades. It's essentially the same amp, just it's a little bigger. And, you know, it's meatier. It has more, you know, more watts.
Yeah.
So we're using, you know, we're using those. That really helps from place to place. If we have to fly somewhere and we can't really bring the back line, we just have... the back line there, and you just, you know, you're plugging the memory stick and it downloads the whole show. So these amps are just really phenomenal, just really incredible. All you need is your pedal board, you know, you're good to go.
Yeah. How do you conceptualize your guitar tone? Like, how do you see it in your mind?
Well, I work with a great engineer here, you know, Adair, and he helps me put stuff together in the studio as well as putting the sounds together, what you would be able to really make happen live. You know, I kind of, you know, you never really want to record something that we're never able to play live. That's always a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to keep it in a realistic kind of fashion and say, okay, we can recreate this in a live setting or recreate that. Because essentially that's what you're doing when you play live. People want to get the same feeling that they got when they listen to the record live.
Yeah.
So it's, that's the battle there. So just being able to make that happen is, you have to keep that in mind. Just has a realistic approach to it.
Yeah, guitar tone is such a you know, a personal thing. Like for me, I have synesthesia, which is where you know, perceive like colors and, you know, textures and things to sound and stuff. And so, you know, my idea of a perfect guitar tone is like, it's kind of like a glass bottle, and it's kind of like, it's tinted rainbow colors and there's light shining through it, and that's what I want my guitar to sound like. You know,
I get it.
it's kind of frustrating sometimes. It's like, man, why won't this sound more yellow?
Right, yeah, you see things and you hear, you kind of visualize in color. That's interesting. Yeah, great.
So in terms of touring, I know that before you got sick, you were planning to come down here to Australia, and unfortunately that had to be, you know, held off. Any plans at this point to come back, or are you just kind of trying to, you know, get on with the record and stuff?
I don't know what the touring plans are as far as after that. I know there's some different things on the table. We're always ready to play. We're everybody's healthy and ready to go. So I'm sure that's, you know, the agent and my manager are all discussing, you know, how we're going to go about that. But, you know, as it is in front of me, I don't know what that is. I know what's in front right now are the 28 dates, but we definitely are looking forward to coming coming to Australia again and playing. We're really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Something I like to ask people, and you always get a different answer, is what does the guitar mean to you?
Well, you know, music in general is the meaning, because to me it's a tool. Mm. As the piano is, you know, and I started both of them relatively at the same young age, so I have a completely different view as to somebody that went to their neighborhood, you know, a guitar store or something and took guitar lessons and stuff. I didn't study it that way. I really studied piano, and primarily it was my ear that got me involved in, you know, improvising on the guitar.
Hmm.
And so from there, I learned different things to do and approach it that way. So today, it's, systematically, it's an expression tool. And it's something that I felt really at ease improvising with a lot. And it's just such a personal instrument. Any of the instruments that you have your finger, you know, on the string are very personal to me. It's different. It's a difference, you know, with a piano, you're throwing darts.
Mm.
You know, once you push that note down, that's it. It's gone. So,
yeah.
But at least, you know, with the guitar, your fingers are always on it. And had I not played the violin, I don't know if I would have played the guitar. But to me, it's an interesting place.
Yeah. What are you listening to these days?
I don't really listen to much of anything. I mean, it just when I'm driving the car, I can have anything on. You know, there's no one particular thing that I've ever really listened to. I play a lot of music, play a lot of classical still. You know, there's not too much more in the romantic era that I haven't played. But I do, spend a lot of time writing. And so that negates really for me listening to too much of the other stuff, because essentially what might happen is you might be spinning out the same thing you're listening to. So
yeah.
I try not to listen to too much, you know, things. I just really kind of stay involved in what I'm working in.
It's funny, you know, I tend to write, you know, instrumental kind of shred stuff, I guess you'd call it. But I don't listen to much of it anymore. I used to listen to it like constantly, that's kind of the vocabulary I speak in when I'm making music. But when I'm recording it, I tend to listen to like Crowded House or The Cure or something that nothing to do with what I'm.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I tend to.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you have to be really careful because you know these things influence you in a certain way. You might be writing a Beatles tune and not realizing it.
Yeah. Or in my case, you know, wait, that's a Steve Vai. Like, I can't do that. I better go back to listening to, you know, Psychedelic Furs or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that will probably do it unless there's anything else you wanted to make sure we mentioned.
Seeing everybody out there, and we really appreciate and love the listeners, and can't wait to play live in a venue near them.
Mm-hmm.
And look forward to coming back to Australia very, very soon. And if you check out TonyMcAlpine.com, you'll see all the tour dates and what the plans are in the future. Stay in touch, and we look forward to seeing you out there.
Thank you, Tony. So here is my slightly edited interview with another Tony, Mr. Tony Iommi. And you'll probably hear car noises and traffic, and you'll hear my voice bouncing off my windshield. But, you know, it was too cool of an interview to not kind of present to you guys. So enjoy me fanboying over Tony Iommi.
Tell me about the CD that you guys are selling exclusively at the concerts.
Yeah, well, it's... when we recorded 13 album, we recorded 16 tracks, 16 songs, and Rick Rubin put 8 on the album, and then we had some bonus tracks went out as well with the album, the double, like a double CD, and then so we had these other songs left over, and I thought we were going to actually do some more songs to make another album, but we all decided at the end of the day not to do it and to tour.
Yeah.
So we had these tracks and we thought, well, yeah, we should put them out. It's mad just to leave them, you know.
Mm.
So we had the idea of just selling them at the shows, and so it's something a bit different.
Yeah. I was at the one of the two shows you did in Melbourne a few years ago, and I loved, like, at that point 13 hadn't come out yet, it was still a few weeks away, and I loved that we got to hear, I think it was 3 or 4 songs from the new record. Like, not a lot of bands play that much stuff, even, you know, huge bands don't tend to play that much new stuff. It was great.
Well, no, I mean, we did do that, but I mean, of course, it's always difficult playing so many new songs because of the people really want to hear the old songs, but they want to hear the new songs as well. But you know, you'd be playing there for 3 or 4 hours if you was to play everything people wanted to hear.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was different to do that. At the moment, at the show, we just do a lot of mainly stuff that people want to hear from the old stuff.
Something else I found really cool about that concert was that the crowd really seemed to accept Tommy. Like, I noticed he got a standing ovation for his drum solo, which doesn't always happen for drum solos, but especially in those circumstances.
No, it doesn't. It's funny because when we talked about, doing the format of having a drum solo in the set, you always wonder, and I think, well, it's difficult for a drummer to do a solo and hold people's attention. But I must say, Tommy is an exceptional player. He's such a fantastic player. I mean, he amazes me every time. And I'm backstage in my little dressing room tent, and I can hear him. And I love the stuff he plays all the time. He just never ceases to amaze me. He's such a great player.
Yeah.
And he goes down well.
Yeah. So let's talk guitar stuff. One of the things that's always interested me about your playing is the way that you would often double track guitar solos, and you'd have like two going at once. And I was thinking, that's something I never really heard anyone do until you did it. How did you come up with that? Was it an accident or?
Well, yeah, I suppose it was really, yeah. I mean, I just liked the effect of having two guitars going at the same time, playing, you know, slightly different things. And so we kept it, really. I mean, it was a bit of a fluke. I mean, we'd do the track, and I'd play the solo, and then, oh, I'll just try another solo, and then we happened to play it back, and the two tracks were there. Oh, that's a good effect. And so we kept it, really.
Yeah. Well, you've always seemed to be someone who knew when to use the studio and when not. Like, you listen to something like Paranoid, where there's the ring modulator in the, you know, on one channel in the solo, or, you know, Killing Yourself to Live has like those kind of wobbly tremolo guitar parts kind of buried in there.
Yeah, I do like to I've always liked to experiment and try different things, you know. I mean, of course, in the early days it was difficult because you had to sort of make the sounds yourself, because you couldn't go and buy a gadget and plug it in and get this sound.
Yeah.
So sometimes it would take ages, you know, and of course the rest of the band would think I'm wasting time. That sort of thing. Oh, bloody hell, what's he doing, and why is it taking so long, you know? But you're trying stuff and you're trying to make a sound, because you can't buy a gadget that did it in those days.
Yeah. And then 40 years later, people are still talking about it in interviews, so... So tell me about your current live guitars. I guess you're using, what, a mix of Gibson and the JD stuff, or?
Yeah, Gibson and JD. I've also got a new Epiphone out at the moment now.
I actually have one at the house right now to review.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, great. And it's getting some fabulous reviews.
Mm.
I'm really pleased with it. I mean, as yet, I haven't used it on this tour on stage as yet, because it still wants a bit of fine tuning. And by the time we got it and left from England, I didn't have time to have anybody work on it, just to do the final touches for me. You know? But it is a really nice guitar. But I'm using the JDs and Gibson at the moment.
Yeah. The Gibson pickups are really cool. They're very bold, you know. There's a lot of edge to them. You can hear a lot of the attack.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we worked on those quite a long time ago, and it did take a bit of getting them right. I mean, I went to Nashville and stayed there for a couple of weeks, going over to the factory every day, working with the guys on them, and so they'd wind one and I'd try it and go no, and then wind another one and try it, and that's how we did it until we got one that I thought was felt right, you know. And then of course I'd go on the road and test it. So yeah, I do like them.
Yeah. So tell me about your Laney amps. Now, you've been with Laney for a long time.
Yeah, way back to the 70s. they started roughly around the same time as we did, really.
Yeah.
And so we sort of started off with Laney and together sort of built them up.
Mm.
And, you know, and I've gone away from Laney and come back, gone away again. I've always tried different things, but I've always gone back to the Laney. And then eventually when... But because at one point Laney stopped doing tube amps and went to start doing transistor stuff, and that's when I stopped. I said, oh, no, I don't want a transistor amp.
Mm.
And then eventually the Lyndon Laney came to me and we said, well, yeah, I'd like to have a tube amp again. And he said, oh, I'd love to build some tube amps again. And that's what happened. We started them off again and started doing them.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I like them. We still, funny enough, I've got a set on the road with me now of new old amps, if you know what I mean. I've got an original Laney, which were very difficult to get onto.
Mm.
And we've rebuilt the thing, and I had a guy do it, and then Laney had it, and they've copied them from the original design. Because nobody at Laney at that point knew how, had seen one, because they're all too young, you know, the people that work there.
Yeah.
So it was like a bit of a thing for them to, oh, where are we going to build this amp? And so I'm basically got them on the road at the moment, and I'm testing them on the tours. But that'd be really great. It's right back to basics again, just the regular amp, no preamps and nothing like that.
Yeah.
It's right... used to have it in the early days, a straight amp, and then I use a little booster, a treble booster, to like I did in the early days, to drive the input.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I guess while you guys were inventing, you know, the songwriting style of Black Sabbath and the riffing style, you also would have had to invent the way it sounded, you know, and these were guitar tones that no one had a reason to use until you came along.
Well, that's right. I mean, you had to do everything. There was no... You just couldn't buy the things that exist today. So you had to make your own sound, your own... The way you use it and try and make the amp adjust to you, what you want it to do and how you want it to sound. And, and that's really what you've done. I mean, today you can go out and buy whatever, so all these things of different sounding amps, stuff, which I mean, some of them are really good, but I still like, you know, the sound from the actual tubes as opposed to a gadget making the sound. You know, I don't really like using fuzz boxes and all that sort of stuff. I like to have the sound from the amp.
Yeah, and I understand you use a pretty unique wah-wah pedal, yeah?
Yeah, I had a Tiger Bay, which Tiger Bay used to work with us in the early days. They used to make PAs, sound systems, and they were very good. And they started going into, they said, oh, they'd make a wah-wah, and they made another bass thing, like a bass-type wah-wah. And they were good, and they only made so many, and we used them, and then I had them for years and years, and then a company in Chicago started trying to reproduce them, you know, copying them really.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some of those as well, so I use them now.
Yeah, it's a great sound. Like it's very different to a lot of other players' wah-wah tones.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried a lot of the other wah-wahs, but I've never found one that I've sort of been comfortable with on stage.
You know? Yeah,
but I like the. They're called parapedals now.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now, something that I notice is in the news today is that you've mentioned the possibility of working with Tony Martin again. Now, I'm a huge fan of that era of the band. For me, you listen to especially Tyre and Headless Cross and Cross Purposes, and to me, those sound like progressive metal albums that came out 15 years later, you know?
Yeah.
How do you kind of feel about that whole era of the band? It was so different, but it really holds up now.
I really liked it. I enjoyed it. I mean, I've got to enjoy it. I wrote the songs. but I did it. I enjoyed it. It was a different thing, and we had a good run, really. Mm. But I did say this in just passing. I mean, when I'd done an interview the other day, and suddenly it's come out saying, oh, he's going to work with Tony Martin. And what it was, the guy asked me if we're going to put any of the redo any of the albums to put out, you know. And the answer was, yeah, I'd like to do that. It's to put out reissues of the albums, but also I'd like to have a look at Forbidden and re-try and mix that again,
probably,
because it wasn't good. The guy who did it, I didn't like it. And that's what I said when I said, well, yeah, and I'd like him to maybe record a couple of tracks with Tony to put on as a bonus thing.
Mm.
So that's sort of where we're at with that.
Yeah. I mean, he's a phenomenal vocalist still. Like, I've kept up with his career, and he, you know, he still sounds great.
Well, he is, and it's a shame because in the day, you know, it took a lot of people to accept him.
Mm.
And, you know, it took all these years later when people say, well, blimey, yeah, it was a good band, or it was good singing. But it took a long time to sort of get people to really realise how good he was.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I've always thought is that Headless Cross would make a hell of a, like, stage show, you know, West End kind of thing. It'd be a very dark one, but you could do it.
Well, we used to do most of that album on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, for me now, after this these tours with Sabbath now, I'm not going to be doing tours again.
Mm.
I mean, I might do the occasional shows, but I'm certainly not going to be going out for a year and stuff like this anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, if I was, I'd be doing it with these guys.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, that's sort of the plan, is to basically retire from touring.
Mm.
And I still like to record. I still like to do stuff involved in music, but just touring for me now is very... I get very tired. I love doing the shows, but it's all the travelling.
You know? Yeah.
You get very exhausted with it, and arriving at 4 o'clock in the morning in a hotel doesn't excite me anymore.
Well, I imagine you must have lots of things you would like to do with all this non-touring time. You must have so many song ideas and potential collaborations and stuff that you've always dreamed of, but never quite had the time.
I've got, honestly, hundreds and thousands of riffs and songs I've just never got round to using, really.
Mm. Mm.
But it'd be interesting to have the time to be able to sift through the stuff and see what I'd like to use. But what I tend to do, though, is not go back on stuff. I tend to start writing new stuff, so then it accumulates more then, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've always liked the little instrumental and acoustic interludes and stuff that you do. Like, an album of that alone would be great.
Yeah. I mean, it's great because I'm quite excited about sort of being able to experiment more as well in my own time, as opposed to, you know, we've got to do an album, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. So it'll give me a chance to be able to really look at things like that.
Okay, thanks for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed that, and I'll be back soon with more, including Matt Heafy from Trivium, Kenny Aronoff, Dweezil Zappa, Mark Seymour. I've got so much stuff already recorded or about to happen, and I'm really excited about where this is going to go. So if you can bear with me as I try and learn how to be a podcast guy, I promise I'll always have some cool content for you. Cheers. The sad machine of mine.